We left off last time. We were just beginning Tosfos, and Tosfos had asked the question on the Gemara had said in Ksubos on the last page. The Gemara had said asked the question in a situation of sakana, why did they not just tell the young women that if the knight, I don't know what it was in the Persian period, if the ruler, the hegemon, decided that he wanted the first night with the bride, rather than changing the wedding date, it's very strange from our perspective, but Takana the Chacham was very important to have it Wednesday night, rather than change the wedding date, just lidrosh lehu da'onesh shari. Why don't you just tell them, you don't become us to your husbands, and therefore, don't resist. The Gemara answers, incidentally, mishum tznuos or mishum prutzos. The reason why they moved the wedding date, in other words, you're right, if the woman, was nansa, it wouldn't be a problem. However, because some of the women were tznuos and would still refuse to go along, and they'd end up being killed by the hegemon, and there were some women who were prutzos, who would say, okay, well, while I'm doing it, I'll just have fun here, and would essentially be willing participants, and they would become nesaros to their husbands. So because of that, the Chachamim decided it might have been better to move the wedding date. So Tosfos is fixated on the one question, how could the Gemara tell them, v'lidrosh lehu da'onesh shari? And as we mentioned last time, onesh shari can mean two things. It can mean, number one, that she remains permitted to her husband, but number two is that the act is not prohibited to her because she's under duress. And the question that Tosfos asks, v'lidrosh lehu da'onesh shari, v'im tomar, the beginning of Tosfos on the last page, v'ha amrinam b'perek ben sore umore, al kol averos yavor ve'al yehore, chutz me'avodas kochavim v'gilei arayis v'shvichos damim. So this is Gilei Arayos. The woman has already had Erisin, maybe Nisuin. Also, it doesn't matter whether she had Nisuin, whether she had the Chuppah. So it's Gilei Arayos. So why? What do you mean, tell them that it's permitted? It's not permitted. They're supposed to give up their life. So V'tireitz Rabbeinu Tam, De'ein Chayav and Misa al Be'ilas Mitzri. So this is a situation where we might like the outcome, but not necessarily, we might always be comfortable with the formulation or the method in getting there. Rabbeinu Tam, Bilas Mitzri is, I don't know if it's, it may not be a censor's term, but it doesn't mean only a Mitzri. A Mitzri means any non-Jew. You'll see why later, in a moment, why Rabbeinu Tam, why that term is used, Bilas Mitzri. The Rachmana Afgare Lazare the Mitzri. That the Torah was mafkir, the zera, the seed of a mitzri, dichsim vizirmasu sim zirmasam. The Navi there is talking about the Egyptians. It's one of, is he talking about the Egyptians? Yes, it's talking about, I think the Egyptians. And he says, asher bisar chamorim bisaram vizirmasu sim zirmasam. It's not a very nice description of them, right? Their flesh is like the flesh of donkeys, and their zirma, which is taken here to be their seed, is like the seed of horses.
That puzzle is from Yecheskel, not from the...
it's from Yecheskel, but I think it's earlier than the...
No, so I'm saying it's with... what is that?
That's Masi, you mean?
Yeah, is it...
So Rabbi Natan would just say it's a Gilu Milsa Alma, right? Just wait for a second on that. Let's see what his position is. So Rabbi Natan says that there's no Misa based in on an Ashes Ish who's Mezana with a Goy. That's what he says. And then from that, he concludes that if there's no Mises based in such an act, then there's no obligation, it's not Yehering V'Yabar. Now, it is interesting, like we probably mentioned this at least at one time before in Shir, that there is actually a distinction, everybody agrees to, between a Jew and a non-Jew in terms of an Ashes Yisrael who has an affair, which is that a child born of an affair where a Jewish woman has an affair with a Jewish man, the child is a mamzer. The child born from a Jewish woman who has an affair with a non-Jewish man is not a mamzer. There are two deos in the Gemara as to whether or not the child of a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man is a kasher or a mamzer. And that's true whether or not the woman is married. It's independent of her being married. There is a shita, which we, thank God, reject, that a non-Jewish a Jewish woman who has a child from a non-Jewish man, she can be single. The child's a mamzer. The reason for that is because the reason for that position is that usually the principle of mamzerus, the way it's usually constructed by the Gemara, is that any child of a union where there could not potentially be kiddushin is a mamzer. So let's say, for example, a contrary example, a kohen is not allowed to marry a grusha. But if a kohen takes a ring, takes eidim, and marries a divorcee, so the kiddushin is binding. She's married, she's an eishes ish, and you need a get to dissolve that marriage. And she's a full-fledged eishes ish. He's not allowed to stay married to her, but they're still halachically married. There is kiddushin. Therefore, the child of a kohen and a grusha is not a mamzer. He might be a halal, or she might be a halala, who maybe halala can marry a kohen, but that's the only restriction. They can marry a Yisrael, a Levi, and so on, because the child's not a mamzer. So any marriage in which the kiddushin are binding, even if it's ba'avera, the child won't be a mamzer. But when you have a kiddushin, correct, the concept is called kiddushin tofsin. The kiddushin take hold, they grab. But if kiddushin are not tofsin, if the kiddushin are not binding at all, the way we paskin, if a man goes up to his sister and gives her kiddushin, she doesn't need a get. The kiddushin are not binding. The child from such a union is a mamzer. So a goy is a mekadesh, a woman, the kiddushin are binding. So at first glance, it would be obvious why the child of a union between a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man would be a goy, would be a mamzer. But the reason we paskin, the reason for the other opinion in the Gemara, and the reason why we and the reason for our psak, therefore, is that the only time that we use the absence of kiddushin binding as an indicator for mamzerus is when both parties are sort of in the framework, in the parsha of kiddushin, but they're not allowed to marry one another. But a nachri can't have kiddushin with anybody. I mean, he can marry a non-Jewish woman, obviously, but that's not kiddushin in the halachic sense. So since a nachri, it's not that that this man and this woman together can't have kiddushin, is that this man is not in the parsha of kiddushin, so that is irrelevant to the calculus of whether or not the child's a mamzer, and that's the way we paskin. So we do assume that the child of such a union, even of an eishes ish, even if the Jewish woman is married, we assume the child's not a mamzer. But that doesn't mean that there's no afeira. It doesn't mean that there's no misa spaced in, and so on and so forth. But Rabbi Natan's claim is that there's no misa because bias nachri is like bias behema. Now a word about bias behema. We have a whole parsha of Arayos in Parshas Achrimos and Kedoshim, most of whom are blood relatives or relatives by marriage, with a handful of exceptions. The exceptions are an Eishes Ish, a married woman, a Nida, a Zachor, male homosexuality, and Behema. The way the Halacha has treated those four is really in two categories. The first, they all entail their own penalty. Eishes Ish, adultery, entails the death penalty. There's a spectrum of penalties depending upon who the parties are in the particular adulterous relationship. But it's the death penalty. The punishment for Nida is only Karis. There's no Mises based in. The punishment for Mishkav Zachar, for homosexuality, is Skila. And the punishment for Behema is Skila as well. However, the Halacha regards the first three, all but Behema, as effectively being Gile Arayos. So we would apply to this, the Ran says this in Sanhedrin, we apply to it the principle of Yehereg HaYavar. Right? This is considered, you know, again, what Gile Arayos, as opposed to just being what we would call Isurei Bia. In other words, there's a prohibited sexual relation, and then on top of that, some of those are in the category of Arayos, many of them are. Bias Behema, even though it involves the death penalty, bestiality, nonetheless is not regarded as Gilei Arayos. So the Ran says, I believe in Sanhedrin, in Ben Sar Amora, says there would be no death, there would be no obligation to give up one's life in the situation of a Behema. And, for another example, and this everybody would agree to, not just Rabbeinu Tam, supposing a married woman, you know, engaged in an act of bestiality with Behema, we wouldn't call that adultery so that she is no longer permitted to her husband. Right? It's just, and in addition, let's say for a Kohen, right? So a Kohen, there are three women who are prohibited to marry a Kohen Hedyot. A Grusha, a divorcee, a Chalala, who's, let's assume the simple definition, is the product of a prohibited relationship of a Kohen and someone he couldn't marry because he's a Kohen. And then a Zona. And the question is, what is the definition of Zona? I mean, Zona, we know, colloquially, we know what the term Zona means. Zona would be translated as a prostitute. But what, halachically speaking, the way we paskin Zona doesn't mean, you know, we would say that a woman who is sleeps with many men, in Yiddish, we might call she's a Zona or something like that. But that's not the halachic definition. The halachic definition of Zona is a woman who has a sexual relationship with a man with whom, I'll take the simplest definition for Rishonim, with whom kiddushin would not be tofsin. In other words, if you have What's that?
So is that an anju?
An anju is one example, and erva would be another example. It means, you know, what it means, most halacha lemaisa, which is sometimes a little thorny bisman hazeh, is that when someone is misadir kiddushin with a kohen, I've been misadir kiddushin many times, but not a single time has the guy been a kohen, which worked out that way. I don't know how that's been. I come close a couple of times, but never gotten there. Which it makes it easier because when you ask questions, you have to ascertain that the couple is allowed to marry one another. You ask some basic questions about yuchsin, about going up a couple of generations in the family, divorces, conversions, and so on. And if you have someone who's a kohen, so you're always in this. You don't know this. Depending on the situation, you do have to worry about whether the woman he's marrying is not a basula. It's not a problem if she's not a basula because she slept with Jewish men. But if she slept with a non-Jewish man, then that would be a problem. So the definition of zona, again, is a woman who's had a relationship with a man with whom kiddushin would not be tofsin. So there, what about a woman? What about a woman who had a bestial relationship? So she's not disqualified from marrying a kohen gadol. Why? Because it's not considered. It's isurei bia. But it's not, in other words, the behemoth's not a person and doesn't have a status, and it's no different, fundamentally speaking, than being Mechal Shabbos, which entails skila. It just happens to be the way the act takes place is an act that resembles bia, but it's not really considered bia. Different from all our other ayahs. So Rabbeinu Tam, the wants to take it almost literally, bias nachri could bias behemoth. And therefore, it doesn't entail any change in the, it's not Yehir Ve'al Yavor. And according to Rabbeinu Tam, what should emerge also, which would be astounding, is that bia. What's that?
Even not onus.
That's true. Not onus, by the way. Now, is there Rabbeinu Tam. Well, I mean, it's usur if it's not onus, yes. but that wouldn't change the status. And also, according to Rabbeinu Tam, it should turn out that a woman who had an affair with a non-Jewish man should not be asura to her husband, Ashes Cohen or not. Right, because it's not an act of bia in that sense, certainly not of arayos. It's just a prohibited act. It's like eating chazir, but it carries this death penalty skila. It's like being mechal shabbos. It carries the exact same death penalty. Right, it's just a different avera, but it's not considered bia. It's no different than any other outside of the parasha of arayos, a prohibited act. That's what Rabbeinu Tam's position boils down to. Now, it's a little bit uncomfortable, at least for me. I assume others share that thing. This equation of a non-Jew to an animal. Now, Rabbeinu Tam was not suggesting this for all purposes, and Rabbeinu Tam actually had an agenda here. This sounds like something that you might think that this is an abstract position. It was very much not an abstract position. Rabbeinu Tam developed this idea based upon the Gemaras, but to address a particular problem, as we'll see, that he had, a leniency that he was looking to create. But that's what Rabbeinu Tam says. V'tiretz Rabbeinu Tam, again, the second line, in chayavan misa al v'ilas mitzri, the rachmona afgerei lezare. The Torah has, in effect, declared his zera hefker, the zari, the mitzri, the chsiv zirmasu sim zirmasam. Umaisi raya. And he brings a Rabbeinu Tam brought a raya, and now you're going to see why we're doing this. The parech beperek ben sora umura. The Gemara we just read last week. The Gemara asked the question, ha ester parhes yahavai. So the Gemara wanted to know, after the Gemara first said that there are gimel averes today, Yehir Gdel Yavor. And then the Gemara said, on every avera, you have to give up your life if it's b'far hesya, if it's public. So then the Gemara asked the question, but what about Esther Amalka? Right? Esther Amalka, what she was doing, Hachashverosh, was effectively public. So why did she go along? Why didn't she just let herself get killed, refuse to go along with it? So the question, Rabbeinu Tam says, but there was a more obvious question. Why did the Gemara ask from Parhesia? Why didn't it ask? Esther was married to Mordechai. V'loha Esther gilei arayos havya. So why did the Gemara immediately, before you got to Rav Yochanan's Chiddush, that all averos in public, you have to give up your life because of Chil Hashem, well, as soon as the Gemara said that gilei arayos is Yehir Gdel Yavor, they immediately should have said, but what about Esther? Well, Esther gilei arayos havya. So Rabbeinu Tam's argument is what? That because Achashverosh was a guy, it wasn't Gilei Arayos, and Esther, on the grounds of Gilei Arayos, wasn't obligated to give up her life. But it's still an Avera, sleeping with this, or certainly being married, in that sense, even if it's not halachic marriage, but derech hasnus, in a manner of marriage to a non-Jew. So how could Esther go along with it? Because it was public, any Avera in public, even if it's not Gilei Arayos. So that, Abaye gave his answer, and Rabba gave his answer. But the bottom line is, why did the Gemara not ask on Gilei Arayos? Rabbeinu Tam says, because Gilei Arayos isn't relevant by a goy. That was Rabbeinu Tam's Chiddush. Now, Hamashma, the Mishum Arayos, Lohava Michaiva. So that's Rabbeinu Tam's position. So now, of course, why is Rabbeinu Tam so interested in this? Umitoch kach, hitir Rabbeinu Tam, Lebas Yisrael Shehemira. Rabbeinu Tam permitted a Jewish woman who had apostatized. Uba aleha oved kochavim. I assume these two were connected. She was a married woman. She apostatized and, in effect, lived with this guy. Maybe married him, I don't know. And then, apparently she did shuva, and I guess the guy was willing to convert, which was very odd in the medieval period because it wasn't a very safe thing to do for Christians to convert to Judaism. Rabbeinu Tam was matir lekaima laosa of the kochavim kishen iskayer. Rabbeinu Tam wanted to say that they can marry one another. Now, normally, when an ashes ish. When a Jewish woman who's married has an affair, not only is she prohibited to her husband, she's not allowed to marry the adulterer either. Mm-hmm. So in this case, Rabbeinu Tam said, no, it's okay. Why? The principle the Gemara has is that it says, there are two different sources, but one, the more commonly quoted source, is three times in the Parsha of Sota, it says, v'nitma'a, she was defiled, and we say that, and what Chazal says, is that an ishes isha zinsa, willingly, is asura labal, asura laboel, and asura latruma. Right, if she was a Bas Kohen, she can no longer eat truma. She's not allowed to remain with her husband. She's not allowed to marry the adulterer. Those three things. So Rabbeinu Tam says that it's not relevant here to say deloshayach lemeimar echad lebaal echad lebaal echad lebaal the bias mitzri dahavik bias behema. That was where Rabbeinu Tam said this. Rabbeinu Tam was looking to solve this problem. You know, you might say it was almost hakanas hashavim. This Bas Yisrael wanted to do tshuva. She was choseris, and now the guy wants to convert. And now the question is he allowed to marry her? So Rabbeinu Tam said yes, because the act wasn't one of Givei Arayos. Now, Tosis is going to reject this, and is going to, we have a problem, what do you do with the Gemara in Sanhedrin? Why does the Gemara not ask about Esther from Givei Arayos? So Tosis is going to talk about that. But it's worth mentioning here that other of Chachmei Ashkenaz, even though they rejected Rabbeinu Tam's premise, they suggested an alternative way of solving the problem. One of them is cited by the Rush, who claims the following. It's very, very interesting. It's a little bit subtle. The Rush says that the only time you say Echad Lebal, the Echad Leboel, is when, if not for the fact that she were married, she would have been permitted to marry the Boel. In other words, she's married to Yankel, and she has an affair with Beryl. If she hadn't been married to Yankel, she could have married Beryl. So we say Echad Lebal, the Isra's Chal on the Baal, and the Isra's Chal on the Boel, on the adulterer. But if she's already prohibited to the adulterer, because Beryl isn't Jewish, even with the name like Beryl, so his father was Jewish, his mother wasn't. So in such a case, since the Boel is already prohibited for other reasons, the Torah doesn't prohibit the Boel under these circumstances. I want to stress, without going into the details, for those who are familiar with the sugya of Ein Isser Chal al Isser, that this is not what is going on. Ein Isser Chal al Isser means that, it's a question when we apply it, that if something is already Osir, and then a second Isser might come along, the second Isser is not Chal. Just to take an example, we don't paskin this way. Rabbi Shimon's opinion is that, strangely enough, if you're going to eat something on Yom Kippur, better to eat a nevela than to eat kshera. I would formulate it. He doesn't say it that way. But he says the following: if you eat nevela on Yom Kippur of an animal that was already nevela, died without slaughtering before Yom Kippur, you're potter from kares of Yom Kippur and the onus of Yom Kippur, but you're chayv on nevela. Why? Because since it was already usher as nevela, the isser of Yom Kippur is not chal on it. Okay. Now it's an entire sugya. We could spend weeks and weeks on the sugya and chal isser, a number of places in Shas, but that isn't actually what's going on here. The rush is claiming that there really is a principle that Echad Lebaal, Echad Leboel only works when the Boel is permitted to her, aside from the fact that she's married. But if she's prohibited for another reason, then the whole Echad Lebaal, Echad Leboel is when the Baal is prohibited, but the Boel is not prohibited. Others, I didn't see this, so I was looking quickly, but I believe there's a third shita among Chachmei Ashkenaz, a much simpler reason why she's a man to marry the guy. Because a gershin is gayer, kikatan shenola dami, right? When a non-Jew converts, they're born again, and they're not related to their previous relatives, they're a different person. And therefore, when Ruchi had an affair with Christian, so even if you want to say that Christian is now forever prohibited to her because he was the Boel, but when he converts, he's not Christian anymore. He's Chaim, and he's a new person. And she didn't have an affair with Chaim; she had an affair with Christian, and therefore, Therefore, one could argue that to solve Rabbeinu Tam's issue, his concern, you could have solved that by a very different angle, which is simply to say, the guy isn't here anymore, there's someone new in his place. Okay. But if you don't like Rabbeinu, that's what Rabbeinu Tam said, though. This is Rabbeinu Tam's conceptual approach to it. And then Rabbeinu Tam uses that to solve a particular problem. The other Rishonim did not like Rabbeinu Tam's approach. Ve'ein nira lirivam. The end of the fifth line in Tosfos. Rivam says, no, this doesn't make sense. D'hayidei bias avde kochavim nesra labayla. What do you mean? If a woman has an affair, what do you mean the bias nachri ke bias behema, it's not even bia? If a Jewish woman has an affair with a non-Jew, she is asura to her husband. Now, how do you know that? Rabbeinu Tam is challenging that assertion. So he says very simply, ki da omar hacha, the continuation of the Gemara, the ikaprutzos, right? The Gemara wanted to know, why do we move the wedding date? Why do we violate the takana of the Rabbanan and have them do the wedding early when you have this hegemon who likes to be boal all the besulos first to get around him? Why don't you just say to them, lidrosh lehu da onas shari? So the Gemara's answer was, why? You're right, we could have done that, except we're concerned about snuos, who will get themselves killed, and we're concerned about prutzos, who will go along willingly and become asuros to their husbands. That's the implication of the Gemara. So this very Gemara says that if a Jewish, married Jewish woman has an affair with a non-Jewish man, even if the child's not a mamzer, even if you accept, and I'm not sure that's true, that there's no chi of misa, she is asura to her husband. And if that's the case, where does Rabbeinu Tam get off saying bias nachri is not kabias behema? And ubeperek ka'isha shenisarmala gabe ha'isha shenechpesha beina ovdei kolchavim amrinan deberatzon asura labayla. The second perek uksubos, a good chunk of it, deals extensively with women who were taken captives, and the question under what circumstances do we assume that they're allowed to return to their husbands and what circumstances not. Obviously, wives of Kohanim is a much more complicated case. But sometimes, the Gemara says, even the Eishes Yisrael, if her husband wasn't a Kohen, there's a concern that under certain circumstances she might have slept with her captors willingly. So Tosa says, Rivam says, one second, according to Rabbeinu Tam, what's the big deal? I mean, it's a big avera, don't make any mistake, but she's not a surah to her husband, if you're right, Rabbeinu Tam. And then he says, Varmina nami b'megillah. So they're coming, bringing things back to Esther. So there's one of the dramatic moments, in the Megillah reading, is when Mordechai finally pushes Esther to do something, and she says, "V'chasher avanti, avanti." Now, so the pshat in the pasuk is she was risking her life because if Achashverosh didn't stick out the Sharvit Hazav, she was a goner. But Chazal state, "Chasher avanti, avanti," that until now, what Esther was going to do was to willingly sleep with Achashverosh to please him, so she could ask for a favor. And therefore, what she was doing at this point was willing. In the past, Esther could have said, every time she sat with Achashverosh, she was summoned to the king, and she had no choice. But here she's going willingly. So the medrash in the Gemara is, V'chasher avadeti, Tosfos says, mi beis abba, avadeti mimech. Just as I was lost from my father's house, I assume because her parents died or something like that, now I'm going to be lost to you. Because until now, I could have gone back to you, Mordechai, because the Gemara is assuming she was married to Mordechai. I could have returned to you because I was an Eishes Ish, Shenensa. But now, when I'm going to Achashverosh willingly, even if it's for a good cause, nonetheless, it's willing, it's Beratzon, and now I'm going to be Asura to you as well. So Rivam says again, why would Esther be asura to Mordechai if Ahasuerus is a goy and be asnachri could be as behema? Alma legabe baila lo chashiva beilas mitzri could be as behema v'hu hadin leboel. And afal gav de ein zinus lebehema, even though by a behema doesn't make a woman as a zona lekohen, and the ein bias behema poseles for oseres kedarmina beperek ba'ivimto. Nonetheless, bias mitzri, which means any bia of a guy, have ye bia. Ah, and now you say, but what is this idea? The Gemara doesn't have this idea, the afgare rachmana lazare of a guy. So Tosus says the following, v'chi afgare rachmana lazare, when does the Torah declare a guy, his zera is like zera behema? Hani mili de'ein lochayus v'zaro chashuv k'zera behema. It said, now this is a very difficult statement, and I'm not interested in exploring it, but I'm not sure what it means. Zaro in lechayis means he doesn't have a relationship with his child. mean, they're not considered related. Now, this is a little bit odd, because the Gemara in Perek HaChovel actually states explicitly that a goy does have chayis. An eved has no relationship. If an eved has a child with a shifcha, there is no, those children are, the child is not considered related halachically. But a goy's child, who remains a guy, is actually does have chayis for the purposes, for example, of Yerusha. So in other words, it's a little odd to say that ain't lo chayis by a guy. I don't know what Tosus means exactly by it. I'm obviously something that I'm not aware of in this context. But whatever it is, the Rivam says, it has nothing to do with the Bias Nachri being literally Kibias Behema. Absolutely not. Okay. So we still have two problems, which might have one solution. Which is, why does the Gemara say here in Ksubos, Vilidros Lehu Da'onashari? It's not true. Bias Nachri is not Kibias Behema. Bias Nachri is like that of any other person, any Jew. So why would the Gemara suggest Vilidros Lehu Da'onashari? And number two, why did the Gemara not ask about Esther? Why did they only ask, how could Esther do this? It was public. They should have asked immediately. Esther was Gilei Arayos with Achashverosh. How could she submit to it? So Tosus answers, V'yesh lomar, the hachi parech. Lidrosh lehu da'anashari, why? Lefi sha'isha hi karka olam, velo avda maisa. In an act of bia, when a woman is not consenting, her act is considered inherently passive. This is not the only case you can have a passive act in our discussion. As we mentioned, I think one of the other times in this Tosus will say, you can be used as a battering ram and you are passive. You can be used as a battering ram to kill someone else. And that's also called karka olam. And therefore, Tosus claims that Yehari Vayavar doesn't apply. She's not doing anything. Something's being done to her. And Sotosa says the same thing is true here by Yehari Galyavor. But why didn't the Gemara at least ask the question in Sanhedrin and give the answer? And that's why the Gemara waited. The Gemara had to give the answer of Karaka Olam anyway. Why did it wait until it raised the Farhesya issue and not ask the question on the Gilei Arayos issue? So Tosus says, Vahad lo parachasim Gilei Arayos havya by Esther. The pshita le the ika lishanuye Karaka Olam hi. The Gemara knew that it was Pashut, that the answer of the distinction of passive versus active would have been obvious in the context of Yehari Vayavor. V'ein la limsar atzma. There would have been no need, there's no need for a person to give up their life when they're asked to not do something. There's no Yehari Vayavor passively. It's only when it's active. That was a given for the Gemara. Avala inyan chilul Hashem, lo haya nira lo sheyoil tam dekarka olam. The Gemara thought with respect to chilul Hashem, which is the question of appearances and unseemliness, it didn't make a difference whether you were active or passive. It made no difference in people's eyes. And that's why the Gemara had to ask the question, lo haya nira lo sheyoil tam dekarka olam, or mishani, but the Gemara answers no, karka olam haysa v'afilu chilul Hashem naka. The chiddush of the Gemara is that even when the concern is not over the heinousness of an act, or the stain that your performance of a certain act leaves, but rather over appearances and chilul Hashem, even there, there's a difference. The Gemara answers the difference between active and passive. But when it came to Esther, of course the Gemara knew. When it came to Gilei Arayos that she was married, the Gemara knew already that karka olam, the fact that she was passive, would have been enough to explain why she wasn't obligated to give up her life to avoid violating the Aveira. So that's what the Balei HaTosos claim. It's a very well-known sheet of the Balei HaTosos, which is that the obligation of Yehari V'Al-Yavor is only when a person is active, not when a person is passive. So Tosus and Avodah Zarah, which we'll get to either today or probably next week, Tosus and Avodah Zarah will talk about the example they want to use someone as a battering ram, and that a person's not, you know, to drop them on a tinok, and it will kill the tinok, and they're not obligated to give up their lives. Now, yes?
Yeah, just the Esther issue is, I just want to clarify, she's already Eshet Ish when Ahasuerus takes her, because
yes,
according to
the Medrash, she's married to Mordechai. Yes. I'm sorry, Joshka.
One thing that always bothered me about the story, maybe this is not a politically correct way to say it, but Ahasuerus had, at that point, had hundreds of women, right? He has a woman every night.
Yes,
and
a harem.
And and then Esther comes, and she's so impressive that he decides to marry her.
Right. Doesn't well, he's fit? Looking. He's having a beauty pageant where you sleep with the contestants.
Doesn't it beggar belief a little bit that she was totally passive? I mean, when you think about...
Nani, I'll grant you all that. If you want to talk Pshuta Shel Mikra, I mean, I'm not sure how thrilled she was about the process, but if you read the text, the pshat in the text, it doesn't, you know, in the Medrash Mordechai tried to hide her and so on, but I don't think any of that appears in the text. So I would agree with you, but it's in the context of our sugya, it really doesn't matter at all because Tosis is working within the Midrasha construct, and so for the purposes of what Chazal were thinking, you know, it doesn't. And it's I want to talk about this actually because I think there's a very very important issue of how one relates to Medrash, and I think that I'll talk about this in a few minutes. But I think that once you operate with the assumption that the sugya in Sanhedrin and Ben Sora Mor that talks about the Harei Bal Yavor and mentions Esther, if that sugya is assuming Esther was married, then Tosis' discussion makes a lot of sense. It doesn't matter what we really think. Was Esther married to Mordechai? No. I understand that. But if the Gemara was working with if, and that's a big if, was working with that Midrashic assumption, then Tosis' discussion follows exactly from it.
Fair enough.
Now, the Rambam we already saw...
Is it like a Baya, not Rava?
What's that?
What?
We pass
like Rava.
Yeah, we do pass like Rava. In the end, Hanasat's Banshani, but that's only, by the way, that the Rishonim only assume. So 1 second. So the Rishonim assume that even though that both answers are operative, and as Rava doesn't disagree with Abai, but he's giving another consideration, and we paskin in terms of I'm going to leave aside the Gimel Averos for the moment, but all other Averos, we would paskin number one. Oh, actually, I take that back. The Rama may not paskin that way. The Rama may only paskin like Rava. The Rama may paskin that only all it depends upon. The Rama probably paskins by Gilei Arayos, by the Gimel Averos. Doesn't matter whether you're active or passive. And when it's not one of the Gimel Averos, it's only us or what done publicly when it's done lavurei aldas. And if it's done to cause him to violate his religion, but if it's done on us, that's what's permitted. So the Rama, yes, only paskins like Rava. But the Balei Tosfos, I think, state explicitly in one of the longer Tosfosim. I don't think it's in our Tosfos and Abu Dazara or here. But I think in Tosfos in Yoma or Sanhedrin, Tosfos, I think, says that we accept both Abai and Rava. No, it's either would be acceptable, either if you're passive, or if it's the guy's doing it for his own benefit. And with respect to the Gimel Averos, Tosfos assumes that passive is permitted. So one comment about the passive issue. Tosfos in Abu Dazara and in Sanhedrin makes the argument that if they were to take you and want to throw you on a tinok, to kill the tinok, you wouldn't be obligated to give up your life. And Tosfos just takes that as an absolute given, like it's such a davar pashut. And the question is, would the Rambam, in fact, disagree with that? And the answer to that question might be is the Rambam might agree with Tosfos, but he might claim that the analysis is completely wrong. In other words, if you are taken and dropped on a tinok, it's not that you are doing an act of murder passively. Right? You're just a bullet. You're not active, you're not passive in murder. The person who drops you on the tinok is the one who's actually performing an active act of murder. You're just a blunt instrument. That's different than Gilei Arayos, let's say, where even if the woman might be totally passive, it requires, in other words, two individuals to constitute the act of Gilei Arayos. Right? In a situation where a woman would be completely passive, but willing, completely passive, but consents to an act, she's chayeves misa, as Tosfos is going to point out. In other words, the act is one of adultery, even if from a halachic perspective, again, it's not 100% clear always, but the man is virtually always active by definition, and the woman is more likely, not as much, to that degree passive by definition, the punishment in the Avera still exists. What's unique here is that the woman is being coerced. And under those circumstances, Tosfos says, once a person is being coerced, there's no problem if the person is karka olam. But the Rambam disagrees with Tosfos. He doesn't quote you're correct, Sam, he doesn't quote the answer of karka olam. He only quotes Hana Satzman, you know, Rava's answer. And he would probably say, since by the Gimel Averis, that's irrelevant, so the Rambam would disagree with Tosfos. So there's one, I want to step aside into just one side issue which arises because there is actually another solution to the Protoktosis' answer. It's a very simple answer, but it's not obvious. It might be obvious to us, but to the typical person who's steeped in the world of Beis Medrash, it's not obvious. The obvious answer is Esther wasn't actually married to Achashverosh. She was a single woman. And that Gemara in Sanhedrin is not assuming like the Agadita, like the Medrash in Megillah. Now that's not my answer. That's the answer of a very important to me, shown the Ramban in the Milchamos in Sanhedrin. The way the Ramban deals with this question is to say, this Gemara is not working with that particular Agada. And this in itself raises sort of a, what I'll call a larger question of the nature of Agada. I don't know if I've ever given a full-fledged shiur here, but I just want to take a few minutes to sort of address this question, because I think that this machlokas may reflect a broader approach to how one reads Medrash. You know, full disclosure here. You know, when I was a teenager going through, you know, the stages, some would say this was my rebellion as I was getting interested in learning. And I was learning Torah Shvah Peh, and I was also learning a lot of Medrash. And my father would, we would occasionally have some heated arguments about the nature of Medrash. And my father would quote at me, you know, the Rambam says that one who believes in all Medrashim is a fool, and one who believes in none is a scorner. And the truth is that's actually an incorrect quote of the Rambam. But I did grow up a little bit. I did develop a, maybe some would say, depending, some would say a more heretical view, and some would say a more sophisticated view of Medrash. What the Rambam actually says in one of his multiple introductions to Parachelek, which is the 10th parak of Sanhedrin, in his commentary to the Mishnah, it's a very, very long introduction, because he has multiple introductions. That is where, by the way, he lays out in full form the 13 principles of faith. That's the first place he wrote them, and that's the full, that's the fully fleshed out version. In the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam just cites them in summary. And the Rambam there has an introduction to the nature of Haggadah, to the nature of Medrash. And he says that there are three groups of people. He says there are those people who read Midrashim of Chazal, and some of them are so fantastical, they're absurd, and read literally, but because they're reverence for Chazal, they read it and they accept it literally, and they make Chazal look foolish. The second group of the Rambam says, that's the group of the fools. Well-intended, but they make Chazal look foolish. The second group is the group of scorners, the Leitzanim, the Leitzim, and most of them, by the way, he says, are doctors. That's his quote. And he says, those are the people who read the words of Chazal, and they realize this is absurd, but they also take it literally, so they mock Chazal, because they think if Chazal was smart, they wouldn't have said such stupid things. And then the Rambam says, there's a third group, and he said you can probably call it a kat, a group, in the same way that you can call the Shemesh a min. What he means by that is, remember, in the ancient world, the sun was unique. We believe the sun is just one star among many stars, but to the ancient observer, the sun was unique. How many species, how many animals were there in the species of sun? One. So he said you can call this group a kat in the same way you can call the Shemesh a min. It means there are very few intelligent people who read the Midrashim of Chazal and recognize that some of them cannot mean what they mean literally, because Chazal was smart people and they wouldn't have said stupid things. And they understand that those Midrashim are metaphorical. Now, how the Rambam would have seen, in other words, the Rambam doesn't dismiss all Midrashim. He accepts all Midrashim. He just thinks that some should be read non-literally. Now the question is it Midrash like this for the Rambam, that Esther was married to Mordechai, does that defy rational thought? Probably not. I'm not sure what the Rambam thought about it. There is, however, an even more irreverent view of Midrash. It's first expressed by the Gaonim, Rav Shrira and Rav Hai, and they were asked about what is Agada, or they come and say, Agada is basically whatever the Darshan made up. Whatever he wanted to say. And therefore, if there's something that conflicts with logic, you can just ignore it. You know, if it's found in the Bavli as opposed to found in the collection, you should work a little harder to make it make sense. But if it doesn't make sense, you can just dismiss it. Now that sounds pretty, I mean, you don't want to walk around in many circles citing this path. And these were not minor figures. Haigon and Shrira Gon were major, in other words, as the Rav once apparently said when someone cited some Gon arguing or disagreed with Chaim, or some Shita, and the Rav once said, my grandfather could learn better than most of the Gaonim. The Gaonim was part, many of them, they were the heads of the Babylonian yeshivas, but many of them were political appointees. But high Gaon and Shrewer Gaon were not minor figures. They were major, major Gaonic figures who left an indelible impact upon the halacha. So you can't dismiss it so easily. But what exactly did they mean by this? I mean, they weren't intending to be disparaging. So I think the answer actually lies in a passage in the Ramban. Not in the Ramban in his Chidushim on Shas, not in his Perish on Chumash, but in the Ramban's Vikuach, in the disputation in Barcelona. The account that he wrote of his debate in front of the king with Friar Paul, with Pablo Cristiani. The Ramban, apparently, at one point Friar Paul challenged him with one of the things that the debate with Friar Paul marked was a shift. It was part of a shift from Christians trying to prove the truth of Christianity to Jews from the Bible to trying to prove it from the Talmud, that the rabbis would agree with it also. It may sound strange to us, but that's what the shift marked, right? Because the Talmud is the book the Jews pay attention to, not the Bible. So he quoted a medrash, not in the Gemara, that the Messiah was born on the day that the temple was destroyed. Meaning, the Jews say the Messiah hasn't come yet. And yet, the medrash says the Messiah was already born. So the Ramban responded with 2 points to Friar Paul on this. And this is the Ramban's account in his account of the disputation written later. The Ramban said 2 things. He said, number one, I don't accept that Agada. And number two, it proves my point anyway. I think the proof of the point is that if in fact the Messiah was born on the day the temple was destroyed, then Chazal certainly did not believe that the Messiah was Jesus, because Jesus was crucified, 40 years before the destruction of the temple. But then, the Ramban, really important passage is the Ramban says, what did I mean when I said I don't accept that Agada? So the Ramban says the following. We have 3 parts to our Torah. Part number one is Biblia, the Bible. And that is that, and every one of us believes in that Emunah Shlema, and that contains 613 mitzvahs, and we all accept it. The second thing is what we call Talmud, and that is the explanation of the 613 mitzvahs, and we all accept that as well. And then there's a third category called Agada. And what does he say Agada is? It's like sermons. It's like a bishop got up and gave a sermon, and somebody in his audience liked the sermon and wrote it down. And someone who accepts this, wonderful. And someone who rejects it, lo yazik, it's not a big deal. That is, in fact, what the Ramban is saying, is that an agada is, in fact, and that's what many agadas are, they're rabbinic sermons. They're stories that are told in order to teach a lesson. Now, that's the way the Ramban, if you look at sometimes when the Ramban attacks Ibn Ezra, when Ibn Ezra is totally irreverent, and Ibn Ezra just ignores Medrash Agada. In other words, he dismisses it very, very, very lightly, takes it very lightly, and the Ramban in a few places in his commentary gets a little angry at Ibn Ezra. So I'm not sure how you put the two opinions of the Ramban together, but be that as it may, the Ramban here expresses an attitude that really was the Sephardic tradition, the Gaonic tradition and the Rambam and Ibn Ezra that doesn't take Agada, I don't want to say seriously, some may take it more seriously than others, but certainly doesn't take it literally. And if you think about the Ramban's approach, coming back to our sugya, to this extent, the Ramban is somewhat consistent. In other words, the Ramban is saying, listen, that's an agada. The Gemara, the sugya in Bet and Sanhedrin, is not working with the assumption of that agada and Megillah, which is another way of saying that the Amoraim in this sugya don't really think that Esther was married. Ah, but the Gemara Megillah says that Vatilo Levas, Al Tikri Levas, Elo Levayis, she was not like a daughter, but like his wife, and Kasher Avaditi Avaditi, now she'll be Asuratim, because now she's married to him, willing to commit adultery. The Amoraim here are not taking that, that don't really accept that. What do you mean they don't accept it? It means it's an Agada. So the Ramban, in a sense, is consistent with his position, at least the one that he articulates in Disputation. It's an Agada, there's a sermon, it's there to take a message, it's not to be taken so literally. What I'm more interested in, and every time I teach this to my students in the Intro to Bible course, is I would like to see, I think in contemporary times, in Haredi circles certainly, the attitude towards Medrash tends to be very, very literal. Really hyper-literal. And obviously it's not the approach that I take, but I would love to see if there are any Rishon who actually adopt such a position. It is my sense, but I can't prove it, that that position was more likely the attitude towards Agada in Ashkenaz. I can't prove that because I don't have any programmatic statements. In other words, Rambam talks programmatically about Agada. The Ramban in the Disputation does as well. The problem is that if you are a literalist when it comes to Agada, you probably don't need to say anything, right? It's just kind of the default position, right? In that world, if you read a story and the story says X and Chazal tell you this happened, it happened, right? You don't really have to ask the question. So what I would love, I will be grateful to the person who one day discovers for me a passage somewhere where you get, you know, amongst the Balei HaTosos or amongst their kind, someone who says, ah, you know, this Agada, of course, is taken, Agada is meant to be taken literally. I don't think one is going to find that. I think that the only way one can construct a case that the attitude, let's say the Haredi attitude today, was actually existed in the medieval period, is to really collect the data of Tosos like the one that we've just looked at, and see there's a pattern in Tosos, that Tosos is taking Agados from one part of Shas and applying it in other halachic sugyos, so you see that Tosos takes Agada fairly literally. Right here, Tosos did that. Here, Tosos took the Gemara and Megillah, assumed as a fact for halachic purposes that Esther was married, and now plugs it into the sugya in Sanhedrin and comes up with an enormous halachic chiddush which Tosos accepts. It's hard to see doing that if you don't take Agada quite literally. So that is my sense, that that is the general approach of the Balei HaTosos, but I can't prove it. You really have to correct. You have to go through all of Shas, you know, and I think that you will find, I suspect you will find, many cases where the Balei HaTosos are fairly literal in terms of plugging in Agados from one place to the next. But this certainly, unless this is the exception, and I doubt it, this is an example where Tosos is taking Agada quite literally, and hence, from that, he constructs the principle that Karka Olam is a permissive factor when it comes to Gilei Arayos or Yehereg V'Yavor generally. Okay. We have one last interesting part to this Tosos, which opens up a different can of worms, but I'm going to limit myself to talking about what Tosos says and not beyond that. And that's the story of Ya'el. Who was Ya'el? Ya'el was the wife of Chever HaKeni. I don't know if Chever HaKeni was Jewish or not. I don't really know. The Gemara, it's not clear what it's assuming, but the Gemara works with the following premise. When we read the story, Kipshuto Shemikra, so Sisra was running away, he needed a place to hide, the Canaanites had good relations with the Canaanites, with the Cani, and Sisra runs to the tent of Ya'el Eish Chever HaKeni. She hides him, she agrees to hide him, she gives him, he's thirsty, she gives him to drink, he falls asleep, she takes the tent rod and drives it through his head. However, and we may mention this a couple weeks ago, however, the Gemara darshins, that in fact, in order for Ya'el to kill him, she felt that she needed to wear him out first, and she did so by engaging in sexual relations with him. It says, Sheva Be'ilos Baal Oso Rasha, based upon the verbs, we mentioned this, Bein Ragleha Karal Nafal Shacham, Bein Ragleha Karal Nafal Basher Shachav, Sham Nafal Shadud. I probably got the verbs out of order, but there are seven verbs, a lot of verbs in that poetic line in the Shira, and therefore that's how Ya'el tired him out. So the question, of course, is, well, in that case, what are you going to say there? So the Tosos points out, according to Tosos, you might be tempted to say at first, wait, of course it was Mutter. Why? Because she's Karka Olam. Now, obviously, in that story, we would say she wasn't Karka Olam. She was the instigator. Tosos says the following. So before, what happens in the Gemara then? The Gemara started by saying the following. Gedola Avera Lishma Mimitzvah Shelo Lishma. That's a pretty wild statement. That's kind of very dangerous. That's like the ends justify the means. I'm doing an Avera, but it's L'shem Shamayim. Okay. So, but actually, really, it is the question of, do the ends sometimes justify the means? So what's going on there, the Gemara says, and from Eishes Ya'el Eishes Chever HaKeni, because Devorah says in her Shira, Tivorach Minashim, Ya'el Eishes Chever HaKeni, Minashim Ba'ohel Tivorach. She is more blessed than the women in the tent. Who are the women in the tent? The Imahos, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. And so what's the Aveira Lishma and what's the Mitzvah Shelo Lishma? So the assumption is the Aveira Lishma is what Ya'el sleeping with Sisra. The Mitzvah Shelo Lishma are the Imahos sleeping with the Avos, because they didn't do it just L'shem Shemayim. You know, they did it because presumably they enjoyed it also. So the Gemara then basically decides to say, the Gemara says, Gedola Aveira Lishma, Kimitzvah Shelo Lishma. Fine. So now the Gemara asks a question about Ya'el. V'haka mishanya me'aveira. She's getting hana from the aveira. So what exactly is the question? I mean, we knew that. Explain in a moment. So the Gemara answers she didn't get any hana because tovasam shel rishayim is ra'ah hi etzel tzadikim. So any good that she would have gotten from Sisra, she would have considered repulsive. Okay. So here is the question. The question is, Tosa says, Uperek mitzvahs chalitza de parach gabe Yael v'hakamisanya me'avera. So that's the Gemara's question. How could she do it? Umishani tovasan shavasharim rahi etzel tzadikim shehitu bazuama, whatever that means. V'lomishani, why didn't the Gemara say karka olam haisa? She was passive. Tosa says mishum de hasam lo parach amaylo masra atzma. Because the whole issue was not about Mesiras Nefesh. Yael wasn't in danger. Why did she do what she did? She did it because she thought she was, maybe she was, saving Klal Yisrael. Because if Sisera had escaped, what would he have done? He might have raised another army and come back and endangered Klal Yisrael. Therefore, the Gemara doesn't ask Karka Olam. It's not about being passive. Da'aloha lo etzala misa. Da'ad rabba hayatzara shetishmerehu. He needed her to protect him. Elahachi perusha, v'ha mishanya me'avera. She's getting benefit from avera. Lama mishabcha hakasa minashim ba'al tivarach. Why is she being praised? Okay, so anyways, the Tosfos says that the story of Yael is totally irrelevant to this particular question. All right, one interesting closing comment on that, which is, what exactly is the Gemara's question? She's getting hana from avera. So what? She needed to do that to save the Jewish people. Right? Yeah, let's say she did get Hana. Right? Let's say I've got to kill someone, you know, to save a whole bunch of people, and I enjoy killing that person. I really hate that person also. We're going to say, oh, sorry, you're getting Hana, you can't do it. You know, let's say by ordinary rules I'm not allowed to kill the person. They're not an immediate threat. So we're going to say, what does it mean? So the then, what's that?
Byproduct.
The what?
The Hana is a byproduct.
Correct. So the Netziv writes a lot about in his commentary on Chumash about the issue, and in his Tshuvas about Avera Lashma. And the Netziv says the following. He says that there are two conditions that are required in order to break the rules. Meaning, being Mechal O Shabbos to save somebody's life is not breaking the rules. That's the halacha. Right? Lots of things where the Torah says danger to life or some other situations overrided then. But the Gimel Averos, which are Yehiri V'Yavor, by definition, the halacha says that the threat to life doesn't override the mitzvah. But Yael decided that the threat to Klal Yisrael was so great, it was better for her to break the rules, even though she really wasn't allowed to. So the Netziv says that if you're going to violate an Avera L'Shema, two conditions have to be met. And he has a very long tshuva, unrelated to any of this, about a young Rav who came into a town and started raising questions about the Shechita and the Bedika. And he created tremendous machlokas, and the Tziv came down very hard on him. And he said, if you're going to create machlokas, l'shem shamayim, there are two conditions that have to be met. Number one, you have to make a very good calculation that the benefits outweigh the downsides. Right? That it's not yatzah schara behefseda. And number two, it has to be completely lishma. There can't be any benefit in what you're doing to yourself, any hana, otherwise it's just an avera, it's not an avera lishma, and it's prohibited. And that's why the Gemara asked the question on Yael. It's very nice that she was doing avera lishma, but it wasn't lishma because she was getting hana from it. So the Gemara's answer was she wasn't getting hana, and therefore it was lishma. And the Tziv uses this to explain a few things in Chumash, and I'll conclude this year with one particular one. Rav Shechter likes to quote this. Is that when Esav stole the brachas from Yaakov, so it says that Esav got the brachas from Yitzchak and he beat out Yaakov. So it says that when Yitzchak discovers it, it says Vayecharad Yitzchak charada gedolad meod. Okay. Yitzchak trembled. He saw the Gemara says he saw the gates of Gehenna open underneath him. He thought maybe he had blessed the wrong child. Medrash doesn't comment. And when Esau figures out that Yaakov has beaten him to the punch, it says, Vayitzak tzi'aka gdolo maran mod. He gave out this great crest, this great cry. And the Medrash says that as punishment for Esau's behavior, we were punished with this persecution in Purim. Because there, when Mordechai goes out into the city after the decree, Vayitzak tzi'aka gdolo maran mod. So then the Tziv says, I don't understand. Yaakov caused Yitzchak pain. And the Medrash doesn't comment. He does not punish at all for it. He causes Esav Harasha pain. And the Medrash says he was punished Mida Kenek and Mida. How can that be? So the Tziv says you have to understand, and I think that Benny will understand this very, very well. Even those of us who have older siblings will remember from our childhood. you know, why did Yaakov do what he did? He was lying, right? He and Rivka concocted the scheme. So apparently Yaakov and Rivka had decided that it was really important for the future of the world of Klal Yisrael that Yaakov get these brachas. Whether it was the good calculation or not, separate question. That was the decision. It was an Avera, but it was an Avera Lishma. So when Yaakov caused his father pain, when Yitzchak screamed out in pain or trembled in pain, clearly Yaakov got no benefit from it whatsoever. You know, it only caused Yaakov hurt, right? He didn't feel good about it. So that was still an Avera Lishma. But you know, when Yaakov heard his older brother cry out and realized that his younger brother had beaten him to the punch, had one-upped him, had bettered him, so you know, there was that little hana that Yaakov got. It's, got him. And because Yaakov got that hana, therefore it was no longer truly an Avera, purely the Shema, and that's why Yaakov was punished with it, with his descendants suffering over that. So that's how the Netziv, you know, explaining, but that's how he understands the Gemara, that when one decides to break the rules under the grounds, under the premise of the ends justify the means, it has to be 100% Lishma. Because once it's not 100% Lishma, now it's just an Avera Shelo Lishma. Okay, so that's the end of this Tosos. But it's with that background that we have the question of Mesiras Nefesh and Karka Olam that, God willing, next Sunday we will start back in the Gemara of the Zara and see it's a difficult sugya, it's a fascinating sugya, and to see the various steps of the Gemara and how they deal with this question of things that are done under duress.